ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Will Shelton, the founder of Willpower Integrated Marketing, a global marketing agency that leverages the unique culture of salons and barbershops to build a bridge between today's brands and hard-to-reach multiracial consumers. Will, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm so happy to be here. I appreciate you having me on, and I'm ready to share the information with your audience and yourself.
Excellent. One of the goals of this podcast is to create a space to explore new ideas, and sometimes it's new tech or services, and in other instances, exploring management innovation from other industries or sectors and how they can port over those lessons learned there over to the media space, which is why when I found out about you and what you're doing, I was so thrilled to be able to reach out and have you as a guest, because your business embodies both things and taps into an authentic understanding of culture and human behavior. So first, just to set the stage for listeners who aren't part of the multicultural racial community, can you describe how salons and barbershops function in that culture?
Yeah, salons and barbershops are like a cornerstone of African-American community. These are deeply ingrained businesses, and it's a very trusted environment. A lot of these shop owners and their customers, they spend so much time together. They're in there for 2 to 4 hours every week, and a stylist can get more out of you in 15 minutes than a therapist in 15 years. they have a lot of cultural capital that exists, and a lot of people and a lot of brands didn't understand, and it has been a blind spot for them. So they function as a trusted environment, and they've been a safe place for African Americans for the last 100 years. They've even mobilized and organized civil rights movements in the shops because they were segregated businesses to support what the Black community needed. So they've always functioned that way, and not only as a grooming space, but as a space to kind of let your hair down, talk about political issues, sports. It's like a conveyor belt of conversations that go on there. And I almost describe it as the original Black Twitter, because it was so much socializing going on there. It was before you got on social media, you had this going on inside of shops across the country.
Right. You wrote about that in one of your pieces. And in fact, one of my questions for you is, now that there is a Black Twitter, has the influence of salons increased or decreased? Has it been amplified by what's happening online? Is it running in parallel? How are they similar and how are they different?
I think what happened is it's amplified, because what goes on in salons, it's just going to continue, because that's, its own platform on the ground that, you know, they have weekly gatherings there. There's generations that go to the same shop and the same stylist. A parent may be taking their kid to the same stylist that their parent took them to. So I think the conversations that go on in these shops end up on social media, end up on Black Twitter, they end up on Instagram. So for instance, if they're having an issue with a brand and they're talking about that brand in the shops and they want to do some kind of a boycott, or there's like a backlash, those conversations go on Twitter, on social media.
I see. So your career, you didn't start out in marketing and entertainment. You were a salon owner and stylist. So when did you have that aha moment and decide to take what you knew about one industry and apply it in a new way?
You know, I've been a licensed cosmetologist for 26 years. And in the 90s, I own my own hair salon. And, you know, clients come in and we're talking and entertainment conversations come up. I would recommend different movies and they would go see them. And before a lot of clients left, they would ask me, they say, Will, what CD was that playing? I'm going to go buy that. So I had this epiphany. I said, wait a minute, I'm helping the entertainment companies market their products through my shop. So I put a proposal together and I sent it out to every movie studio and every record label I can think of. And I explained to them that this was a captive, receptive audience that had a billion-dollar buying power as well, and that they were missing out on this. And then within 30 days, I started receiving shipments of free CDs and advanced screening passes to give away.
And oh my gosh. So you're still in your salon and you're thinking, I could be a vector, an information vector for these entertainment companies. And so, I mean, that's really not every salon owner thinks about doing that. Did you research the business and scope of what the buying power was? I mean, how did you, that's fascinating. And ballsy, and it worked. So you got to share a little secret sauce there. What was your hook? How did you even get them to open the envelope?
Well, for me, I didn't even know what I didn't know. And, you know, I always tell people, if you have nothing, you have nothing to lose. So that kind of took away the fear. You know, fear is one thing that really holds people back from reaching their potential. So I just say fear is false evidence appearing real. So for me, I said, you know what? I just always had a lot of curiosity. And I think I had the innate ability and the gift to put together marketing ideas, even though I didn't know what it was. I didn't even know what a advertising agency was. I didn't understand any of that. I just knew that I had something that seemed like a good strategy. And I understood from behind the chair, I understood what was going on as far as sharing this type of information and a strong word of mouth that follows this. And I understood that this type of chatter is what propels these companies' products, especially entertainment, because Black people have an insatiable appetite for entertainment. They watch 40% more TV than any other audience, and they go to the movies twice as much. So just understanding that, but not really having a handle on marketing because I don't have a degree in it. It was just really my degree of gift and innate ability. And what I told myself is, you know, you have to just go after your dreams as if your life depends on it, because the life that you want does depend on it. So that just what drove me. And I was just curious. I really was curious to see if this was a viable vehicle for them to use.
So take me, so for phase one is you get CDs for your shop, you get passes to share with your clientele, which of course makes you that much more attractive of a salon. What makes you then decide, I'm going to set the salon aside, or maybe you still have the salon. When did you decide to branch out and say, I'm going to go into this marketing endeavor full bore, and I'm going to network with other salons?
I think it was about a year after, because, you know, I was just so excited to get this free CDs, first of all.
Exactly. Free stuff. It's awesome.
Yeah, I was like, hey, I'm playing the latest music. And they would send it to me before it even was released on the radio. So I had like some real good, cool swag stuff in my shop. So I was happy about that. And then what I thought about, secondly, I said, I'll just use my shop as a pilot program. And I said, you know what, there's thousands of shops all across the country. And if I can put a team together that has relationships with them, I can build a network of shops nationwide in all the different top markets. So that was the first thing I had to do, was said, how do I get this team together? And once I developed that, then I went back to the same studios and record labels and let them know, hey, look, I can get you in the top 10, 20 markets. And not only that, is I can help you take you from the mezzanine to the orchestra section and get you a front row seat with your target consumer. And it took me probably about 10 years, though. It was a side hustle for a while because hair, you know, that was my bread and butter. And I couldn't leave hair because I wasn't making enough revenue from, and I hadn't established myself, you know, as a vendor or a consultant at that point. But it took me about 10 years to really transition all the way out of hair. But I kept doing it and I kept, you know, gaining more new business.
Well, I suppose you also stayed really plugged in to what your consumers were thinking. You know, you stayed right in there. So then you transition out. How do you stay plugged in? I mean, is it that you have this network of relationship with other salon owners? And so you talk to them about what's, you know, how do you stay in the swim of the culture?
Well, two things. Number one, because I was in the industry for so long, I understood how African-Americans thought, how females were hold the purse strings in their households. I understood, you know, what their needs and wants were, and I understood their activity and their outsized influence. And then with my teams and their relationships with the shops, I was always on my pulse, was always down on the street and knowing what was going on and understanding what the next step should be.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. I'm not worthy. I think it's so cool that you saw it and did that. It's so smart. And especially right now, it just shows how smart and plugged in and authentic it is. One of the things that advertising agencies have been blasted for, rightly so, is their lack of diversity. And they've recently released their EEOC numbers, and it's pretty underwhelming. Do you think it's possible for these largely white agencies to connect authentically with diverse audiences?
I think it is. I think it's just a matter of them understanding how transparent they need to be, the commitments they need to be. And I think they need to understand that it's not insurmountable. A lot of times they believe it's insurmountable. And they need to understand also that they have a broken culture within their corporations and that there are a lot of silent agreements that are made there. And they need to understand that if they come out, make real commitments, be really genuine and get the support of people like me, because I've been coaching brands and different advertising agencies now in helping them take the fear away of making a mistake. But the biggest mistake they make is if they don't come out and really make a stand of solidarity, but not just make the stand, but your stance have to line up with your stats in your company. And as well as understanding that, you know, did Black Lives Matter before Black Lives Matter? You know, those are some of the questions that need to be asked, you know, within, and they need to understand that they can't go outside of their company and get the answer. You have to look inside at the convictions of what you need to do and have that kind of discernment and bring the right people on board for that.
So I have a couple of following questions. One is, you say silent agreements, internal silent agreements. Can you unpack that a little bit, what that means?
Yeah. I'll give you a good analogy. You know, I was a big boxing fan and I grew up watching Mike Tyson fight, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a silent agreement that happens with Black executives within the white corporate hierarchy. And Mike Tyson used to have a lot of sparring partners and he would usually knock all of them out. But what would happen is sometimes when he got one that he couldn't knock out, he would start holding them, trying to rest. And his coach told him, you need to stop that habit because you're making a silent agreement when you do that. And one day you're going to get a guy who's not going to sign that contract. And Black executives make that silent agreement with corporate America. And they almost always find out the hard way that the other side hasn't signed that agreement.
I see. So you sign because you think it'll change. You think it'll be a certain way, but the reality is it doesn't. And you end up being an engineer for your own demise.
Yeah. Also, you know, they get tired of battling the microaggressions and the flagrant discrimination at work. And not only do they stay silent, they stop fighting, or they stop fighting with that same intensity that they once had. And they start throwing those don't hit me punches because they no longer are trying to win anymore. They're just mentally trying to survive while waiting for the conflict to be over.
Right. Well, and you made a point about coaching. And so, you know, you have an incredibly authentic voice, sincere knowledge and expertise. So, but you also have your own business. And so, you know, you can advise them, but they need to, if they really want to change how their own culture operates, they need to bring in at senior levels, people like yourself who have authentic, real cultural knowledge. Do you think, I know in retail, sometimes we see a store within a store. In order to jumpstart it, could they do something where they partnered with an agency like yours, where they said, you know, look, we can't do it swiftly enough, or would that be problematic and you'd rather not do something like that?
No, I'm telling them all the time. This is one of the problems. One of the problems is too many companies are highly adjusted to the injustice. And what happens is, you know, they'll say, well, we can't find talent. But there's a pool of talent that's always out there. You know, they usually go to the same colleges or they go for graduates. What they need to do, and what I've been telling them is, look, you need to go down to the JCs. You need to go down to the eighth and ninth grade and have career days and let them know they have the option. A lot of these gifted kids are wired for advertising and marketing, but they don't know they have the option, and no one has been speaking to them and letting them know, you know, how they can start getting into these. So what I look at it as, like baseball. Baseball has a minor league and then they pull you up to the major. So they need to develop a minor league, a pool of talent to bridge that gap and develop a pipeline when they're really young. Forget when they get to college, get them when they're in high school and start talking to them then and recruiting at that time.
Right. Interesting. So you've also written some articles with advice for companies that say they stand with Black Lives Matter around what Black consumers really want to see, what's real, what's meaningful, what it looks like, what inclusion is versus diversity. What are some of the things that you believe Black consumers or all consumers really want to see? What are some sincere things that they want to see and changes that you think are real?
Yeah. Well, what's happening too is, you know, you just, at this time, is a colossal cultural collision in the nation and in corporate America. And one of the things that's happening is Black consumers are really realizing how much power, buying power and leverage they have. And they're holding these companies accountable. They're doing what I call the 150 point inspection, and they're looking under the hood. And they want to know your real numbers. Like I said before, does your stance line up with your stats? So they're doing an MRI on your company.
Right.
To really see, you know, if you guys have those microaggressions, your HR department. You could say, look, we stand in solidarity. But what about a couple of years ago, you have all those complaints filed against you in HR? You know, so these consumers are smart, they're savvy. And remember, today, we had social media. 20, 30 years ago, we didn't. So your company can be boycotted in, you know, in a day or two, and your bottom line's affected like that. So, you know, I appeal to them on a moral level as well and say, you know, you guys just need to heal and deal with this and, you know, fix this broken system so that you're doing what you should have been doing in the first place. But now you're forced to do it. But the other thing is, like, it, you know, consumers want to know, is it authentic? It's like, you know, everybody finds God when they go to jail, but when you get
right, or in a foxhole. Yeah, no atheists in foxholes, sure. So, you know, you also mentioned fear of making a mistake, that people sort of are scared that they'll do the wrong thing. And one of the things I was curious, I'd love to get your take on, I've often heard it said that artists are thieves, but then we have the issue of cultural appropriation. And so I was curious, what is appropriation and what is creative recombination? Like, where are the lines? Like, how does that work? So if you're a creative director at an agency, how do you know, like, you know what, we can't, this isn't okay for us to do, mm-hmm. or it's okay because it's an honorific play on XYZ thing? Or is it just, no, you can't, rough stuff? I mean, like, where are the lines? What is some guidance to offer there?
Yeah, that's a delicate situation. I think first they need to understand the implications and the roots behind the aspects of the culture that they're interested in. More importantly, you know, African Americans, they have an outsized influence in the culture, and 81% more likely other cultures, you know, want to wear the clothes they wear, listen to the music that we listen to, and the other activities that they consider cool. So that's one huge thing that happens. And then the cultural appropriation and the monetizing and the capitalizing on someone else's pain, that's wrong. And mm-hmm. they understand that, you know, a lot of times in Hollywood, you know, they shape how people view Black people. Like, you think about the non-executive producers and screenwriters that have always played a role, an outsized role, in portraying and defining what it means to be Black in America. And they glorify rogue behavior within their films, and drug addicts and different things like that. And they can rethink the movies that they greenlight, so they can reshape the aperture and how people view African Americans in a more positive way, even on commercials.
Right. When you're advising companies, do you ever get brought in before the piece is made? Do you ever get brought in to talk about potential IP, potential films, some sort of, you know, testing the waters, level of interest, or not?
A lot of times a film may be already in the can, but the marketing campaign and making that marketing campaign culturally relevant and resonating with that consumer is so important. A lot of times companies, whether it's a global brand or entertainment company, they try to bolt on the marketing instead of building it into the strategy from the beginning, because African Americans, they're not going to respond. They can tell it's not authentic if you put a marketing campaign out that's just bolted on at the last minute, that's really made for the general market. So mm-hmm. my consulting, from that point of view, I try to help them to make those campaigns culturally relevant and understand, you know, you're just not going to get your return on investment if you throw anything out there, because African Americans, they're just not going to respond to it.
Right. So sometimes it's sort of focus grouping the marketing, or is that kind of, would you help them test it, build audiences for testing campaigns, or are you simply sort of a creative strategic advisor?
More of a creative strategic advisor from the point of view is, how do we approach, or how do we, you know, build this relationship? Or if you want real brand allegiance from this consumer, I tell them they don't want just a banner in a booth. They want a full commitment. So that's the point of view that I'm advising from.
You're in an interesting position because you obviously are offering entree and understanding to a population. What happens? Have you ever had a situation where you're approached to do your work with a brand that doesn't pass the under the hood inspection? And what do you do then? You know, that the brand wants the dollars from the community, but maybe doesn't really, you know, walk the talk.
Right now, since everything's happened in the country with the racial injustice and the solidarity stance and the Black Lives Matter movement, I haven't had that happen now, but in the past, really what I do is I have to give kind of a mini seminar
Right. To educate.
Yeah. And it's over and over and over again, because, you know, they just don't understand. That's part of the reason why they're hiring me, you know, for my expertise.
Right. And
my authority in this space. So I really have to give them an education before we even start going down the road of creating a campaign, and let them understand why and how and what they're going to what they're not going to respond to, really, is what I let them know.
Right here. That will not fly. That will be bad.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So in conjunction with this, this civil rights movement, we obviously have had a pandemic happen, and it's been really brutal on small businesses and especially salons. And what are you seeing in terms of how is the community handling the loss of this cultural gathering point, and how are the salons weathering it?
Yeah. You know, I've been coaching them as well. I had a show on Instagram where I would go on live with different stylists and shop owners across the country. And we would go on while they were shut down. And we would talk about different strategies that they could use while they weren't in the shop, like, you know, video one-on-one consultations and, you know, putting color together, because a lot of the women, hey, look, they needed their highlights and they couldn't get them done. So I was helping them to understand what they need to do now is restructure, because everybody feels like their structure was lost personally and professionally. They feel like their businesses were on life support. But I told them that their business is not dead, and that if they work on their business development now, reforecasting, looking for the opportunity in the crisis, because there are some opportunities in the crisis. Use COVID as your ally right now. Become more agile. They talk about social distancing, but now is when you got to do, especially the salons, of social listening. Listening, you know, send them surveys before they come back to the shop and ask them what's going to make them more comfortable in your place. Because it's one thing to rearrange the chairs, but to rearrange the experience of the shop is totally different.
So it sounds like you're doing, I mean, this is management consulting, and this isn't necessarily marketing. This is pure on community consulting, entrepreneurial consulting, small business consulting. Is that something that you're doing sort of pro bono to, you know, to keep the ecosystem that you use for your marketing business afloat? Or is this something, or did you yourself pivot and say, you know, I've got, this is something I can do as a secondary line of business? Or have you always done it as a secondary line of business?
Well, right now I had to pivot, or I was pivoted. I mean, you really, in this new orbit, in this new abnormal we have,
right?
You have to reposition. You know, it's about positioning. And if you don't position yourself, you're going to get positioned. You know, life is a fight for territory. If you don't fight for the territory you want, the territory that you don't want will automatically take over, usually. So for me, it was both. It was like a pro bono thing, because I knew that these shops were on hospice right now, you know, and they were literally on ventilators themselves. So my calling was to help them. And then if they wanted to go deeper and have longer conversations and more help, I have what I would call pick my brain sessions with them.
Right. That's so smart. You know, we're actually reaching almost the end of our time together. And last thing I wanted to know is, looking ahead, what's up next for you and what's got you particularly excited?
I'm excited to see the opportunities in this crisis. I'm excited to see the innovation, to be innovative myself, and with the ingenuity to develop real solutions for the clients and the global brands that I work with, and to help the barbershops and salons to understand what they're able to do to fight for their legacies and their communities, you know, and continue to move forward. And I know that there's going to be a great outcome. So right now, that's the track I'm on.
That's fantastic. I think, you know, I am so impressed by what you're doing. It's so smart. I think that any entertainment brand that is looking to connect, and a lot are right now, should be reaching out to you, because clearly you understand it in a way that I haven't seen somebody articulate or execute the way you've done. So congratulations and kudos to you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate your time talking to me and sharing.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, all of you, the members of our audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next time right here on Up Next.